Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com.
Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. I am very excited about today's episode. My name is Ben. I got to tell you, did you notice I shaved?
Bonjour, je suis Noël. And you can tell I am French by my outrageous accent.
Sort of a Disney Beauty and the Beast vibe. Not Gaston, the candlestick.
Way.
Mm-hmm. And there's our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Bonjour.
Casey, you're going to absolutely love the cartoonish French accents that I'm going to be dropping throughout this episode, sir.
I'm here for it. Yeah, let's do it.
And you're also here in the same room as us because we're in a different studio, and I really like being able to look right at you and not be separated by glass and, you know, fiberglass.
The barriers that separate us, they've come down.
Casey, I'm partway through this. I'm going to reach out and hold your hand as I do my own terrible accents, and I want you to be ready for that moment when it happens.
I'll prepare myself.
Okay, do. Please do. So the three of us, I'm looking around the room, the three of us all have facial hair of one sort or another. I typically, as you guys know, my beard grows really quickly, so I am always like 3 hours away from a 5 o'clock shadow, and I try to shave it when I want to look clean cut. And Noel,
is that a 2 o'clock shadow?
It usually is about 20 minutes after I shave. And Noel, you yourself have not shaved for years, right?
Not once, not even ever a trim. Mm-hmm. I just let it grow like an old prospector.
Well, you trim it.
I do. I get it trimmed, actually. That is one of the luxuries I afford myself, is when I get a haircut, I get them to trim my beard as well and shape it up, because I'm not qualified to do that.
It's an art, and it's tough when you're doing it for yourself. And in case you've had kind of I would call that a beard, right?
Yeah, it's,
Ben,
it's,
that sounded a little dismissive.
No, because I'm trying to find, because it's not stubble, and there's some interesting studies.
It's somewhere in the middle ground.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I usually maintain the same kind of thing, because there's a fascinating study that says there's this spectrum of facial hair, and people tend to, when they're looking at pictures of strangers, they tend to think that people with bigger beards, like ZZ Top wizard style beards, are more are wiser but less trustworthy. And the people who are clean shaven are more trustworthy, but perhaps with less real world experience. And then in a concurrent study, they found that, now this may be controversial, they found that stubble was considered the most attractive of facial hair.
Interesting.
It's weird, right?
You know why that might be?
Why is that?
Because it gives you it's sort of like half and half. It gives you the benefit of a clean shaven look. You can sort of see the skin still, especially if you have like a nice jawline. And then you also get the ruggedness of a little beard sprinkling, kind of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for you guys about mustaches. Mm-hmm. Is a mustache if it's connected to a beard?
You know, that's interesting because wouldn't it become at that point a goatee of some sort?
It's just all one assembly.
Well, what if the mustache is grown out and waxed and it's sort of its own thing? But
is it called something else at that point? Yeah, I don't know.
Well, according to my autocorrect, which insists that I don't mean to type mustache, but I got to tell you guys this story. Recently, I was looking back at my worst autocorrect mistakes of 2019. I wrote to my mom and I told her, we were in a conversation. And I said, I'm thinking of growing a mustache. And autocorrect turned it into, this is true, I'm thinking of growing a moist ache. Sorry, Mom.
Moist word aversion people are just losing their minds in the audience right now.
I know. Yeah. Imagine the humiliation. Now, I grew a mustache once for a bet, but I've never committed to it. You have to be a specific type of person, I think. You have to have the right facial structure.
Right.
Dare I say the right vibe?
Yeah. I once shaved my beard, except for the mustache, mm-hmm. and people kept telling me I looked like Ron Jeremy. So I never did that again. It also made my daughter cry.
Whoa.
Yeah, because she, like, didn't recognize me. Because she's, you know, I've had this beard since I was about 14, somewhere approaching this level of facial hair since I was at least 15 or 16. And she'd never seen me without it before. And I shaved everything off with the mustache. She was, like, maybe 3, and she lost it. She didn't know who I was.
3? That makes sense, though. That makes sense. And it's weird because when we first meet someone, we assume that that initial meeting, the initial, you know, shot we have of them in our heads is how they always look. That's why it feels weird if you meet someone while they're wearing a hat and then you see them the next time and they're not wearing a hat. And you're like, whoa, what is this plot twist? It's kind of the same way with facial hair. And shout out to everyone listening who grows facial hair, who does that thing. I don't know if anybody else has done this, but when I have a full beard grown out and I like to shave into different auditions for facial hair. You know what I mean? Like I'll do the, what's that mustache that kind of goes down? It's like
the Fu Manchu? Handlebar.
Handlebar. Is that what it is? The one that like,
I think so.
Okay.
It resembles a set of handlebars.
There we go.
But sometimes it usually connects up to the chops though.
Yeah.
And it becomes another thing entirely.
I did that one where you shave everything except right here on the chin line, and I feel like an old-time prophet of some sort.
Yeah, an old-time prophet or like a saloon proprietor,
perhaps.
Yeah.
And so today we are exploring facial hair. I know that mustaches can be a divisive thing, right? Because some people say they'll never condone a mustache. Some people love them. They had a bit of a vogue moment in hipsterdom here in the United States a few years back. You guys remember when people were getting mustache tattoos and like mustache tattoos on their fingers that they would put under their nose? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I thought it was an odd commitment.
Yeah.
Why not just use the finger? The mustache is sort of implied.
It's a tattoo, mm-hmm. You know? They're going to have that for a while.
Yeah.
But back in the early 1900s, in Paris, France, famously home to Le Bouche, mustaches became a huge hot button issue. And it started with waiters. And this is so strange. Like, okay, so Casey, if we could ask you, can you bust a couple of stereotypes? I feel like the U.S. Unfairly gives waiters in Paris a bad rep.
Yeah, they had the classic rep. I mean, it's a very common stereotype, right, of like the rude French waiter, the snooty French waiter. It really has not been the case in my experience. I've had maybe one rude waiter experience where I think my bill came out to maybe €8. I had like €10 to pay for it, and the guy wanted exact change, and I had to explain to him that I only had a €10 bill, and he, with his fingers, is counting out like eight, and he's saying the English word eight. And I'm telling him in French, like, no, I understand 8 versus 10. I just need change. And as soon as I kind of responded to him like in fluent French, his whole demeanor changed and he was very apologetic. And he actually seemed somewhat embarrassed that he had behaved that way.
Huh,
and
Casey, it's almost as though your Francophone nature it precludes you from the rude waiter behavior.
This is true. But even in like earlier trips to Paris, it has been remarked upon that it has gotten more polite over the years. You know, some of the waiting kind of culture that we have in the United States in terms of the tip, and this feeling that it's almost like a kind of emotional blackmail. You have to kind of like act like your best buds with the person you're waiting on. In France, they are salaried employees, waiters are. So they're really not beholden to the customer the same way they are in the United States. It's more of like a trade or something that they practice. So
Does that mean you don't have to tip?
The tip is included.
You could round up.
Yeah, you can round up or something. But
interesting.
But generally, the price of the food includes the tip for the staff.
So do they make a good wage?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
interesting.
And so, it's kind of cool. They, the waiters I've had tend to just be very professional, very quick, very efficient. Mm-hmm. They're not really much for small talk or for hanging out or anything like that. But at the same time, I have not experienced like so much rudeness or abruptness from them. Cool customers and kind of just like there to get you your food and get out of the way.
I despise the American culture of small talk by waiters.
I do too.
And a whole shtick where they have to do this whole song and dance.
Is this your first time here?
Oh, God.
Okay. Well, let me walk you through the menu and how this works. Okay. You're going to want to start with a schnozboz. Yeah. All right. We also have half off apps and we have bottomless toe feet.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, for sure. Love me some tofu, but don't want to hear about it. Want to make my own choice.
Yeah.
Please leave me alone. I'm sorry, any wait staff folks out there. I know you're, I get it. Some people are all about that, and it will get you a better tip. I'm just a curmudgeonly old fart, and I just don't want anything to do with it.
People in the service industry in the United States have one of the most challenging gigs and careers in the country because of tips, which we'll get to in a second because I have an advertisement that I think you'll like. So how you're listening and you're thinking, oh, guys, how are you going to bring these disparate things together? How are you going to bring French culture and tipping and mustaches together? Well, strap in because we are going somewhere with this. Let's start at the very beginning. Archaeologists think that mustaches were always kind of a human thing, even back when people were living in caves. There is strong evidence that members of our species used shells and tweezers to shape facial hair into one design or another.
It was naturally occurring tweezers you always hear so much about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. The common tweezer, I believe, is the Latin.
I mean, I guess the most basic, improvised tweezer could just be two small sticks.
Yeah, sure.
Put together like chopsticks and you just pluck.
Or maybe split a branch.
There you go.
Vertically.
See, that is some very industrious thinking right there, my friend.
Thanks, man. Oh, but although we know facial hair was decorated and can I say manscaped? Does Manscaped apply just to the Australia, or does it?
I think it's trademarked.
Okay.
So you might get sued, but you know what? Let's roll the dice.
This is the Casey and the Case sound cue all over again.
It really is.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I,
yeah.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one, and that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino, and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it so. The Monte Carlo was tough. I owned a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
It still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man, and funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
So when did the mustache, as we know it today, come into being, Noel? Or when did it, you know, really explode on the scene?
Well, it really got its footing, if you can imagine a mustache with feet firmly planted in the cultural zeitgeist, in England during the Elizabethan era. In those days, as you can imagine, the beard reigned supreme. And King James I and his son, old King Charles I, decided that they were going to make a splash and turn this beard thing on its end and make themselves really stand apart from the crowd by debuting their handlebar mustaches.
Yeah, yeah. And the hoi polloi, the masses, followed suit. You know, and this is something we see a lot with fashion in general, right? Some of the more elite, whether political elites or financial elites or just fashion elites, they do something. They're kind of the early adopters of a style, and then it filters down and it becomes more popular mainstream. And that's what happened with the mustache. When Britain moved away from Puritan rule, the mustache stayed, and it was a status symbol. King Charles II had a mustache, and you can see portraits of him in his early teens where he already has his mustache. Peter the Great in Russia attempted to control facial hair through implementing a beard tax. This is a real thing. It was in 1698. He went through Western Europe and he thought, you know, he's like, after my trip abroad, I feel that beards and facial hair are more old-fashioned than masculine. So we're going to charge 60 to 100 rubles for anyone who wants to grow a beard, and they have to have a little token they can carry around. So the three of us would have to pay the beard tax at that time.
For what? Like, when do you have to deliver this? Like, is it like you pay it like yearly or quarterly or just like you get shaken down by, you know,
the beard cops, the beard police?
Sort of reminds me of the butter tax, the indulgence of the butter boxes or whatever. Like, for the privilege and decadence of having a beard, you got to pay.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. And he wanted to incentivize people to be clean shaven. He felt like that would be more Western European of them. So people didn't want to pay the beard tax, of course. Mustaches became the way for men to, in this time, for men to show that they were grown. You know, they were manly men.
I see. And would you have to pay a mustache tax?
No.
That did not qualify for the beard tax.
No, but mustaches were so popular. They have an occasional resurgence here in the U.S., but mustaches were so popular back in this time that the British Army required mustaches as part of their official uniform from 1860 all the way to 1916.
It's true, and we have gotten some of this information from a wonderful article on fatherly.com about the history of mustaches. By the way, check out our partnership with them, Finding Fred, about the delightful Mr. Rogers, who for some reason we have not done an episode about. He had some really interesting things where he spoke out about, you know, war and actually included some pretty heavy topics in some of his early black and white shows.
Mr. Rogers is a veteran as well.
He is, yeah. And really, I don't know. I watched that "Won't You Be My Neighbor" documentary on a plane, and I was sobbing by the end of it. And I texted my kid and I said, "You're special just the way you are." And she knew I was telling the truth.
Mr. Rogers, clean shaven.
He is clean-shaven and therefore much more trustworthy, I suppose, right? Mandy Patinkin, sometimes clean-shaven, sometimes bearded.
Never know.
You never know what you're going to get. But yeah, it's true what you say, that the British Army actually required mustaches. As can you imagine, it's part of their uniform. You know, that's I think of a uniform as his clothes, but that I guess it's a haircut, an army hair. I guess makes sense. Okay, I'm back in it. So by the end of the 19th century, according to this lovely fatherly article, it became a kind of a health liability for cleanliness because, you know, there was more research being done into hygiene. And, you know, there were issues with tuberculosis spreading and such and other diseases. And so beards were started to be looked down on as like a vector of spreading germs.
Mm-hmm. Rightly so. This went across the Atlantic as well. New York City actually banned milkmen from having beards in 1902. Hospitals in Britain forced staff and patients to shave. And because of this new emphasis on cleanliness and shaving, in 1904, a guy with a fantastic name.
Oh, I love his name.
King Camp Gillette got the patent for the first ever disposable razor, and cleanliness became increasingly important. Beards were on a little bit of a downward trend. And I have one gear to grind that I want you guys to take on.
Grind away.
Thank you. Here it is. So when I was living abroad and I was in a place where most things were much less expensive than they are here in the States, with one exception.
Is it razors?
It is razors. Razors were even more expensive than they were in the States. And this
Why
was
is
in
that?
Central America. I don't know. They had a monopoly. So eventually I just let my beard grow out and I came back looking like that era of the Beatles where they all had nice suits but crazy beards.
I love that era. It's true. I will say this, and this is just sort of unrelated, but the fact that I haven't shaved in such a long time gives me a pretty sweet ability to just rock a disguise if I need to, like, go on the lam.
That's true. That's true.
If I shaved and, like, did my hair differently, you wouldn't recognize me.
Well, I would.
You might. It. You might, Ben.
But I wouldn't give you away. Also, kudos to you for not participating in that 2009-2019 facial comparison thing.
I didn't do it.
No, I didn't do it either.
I did not do it for any ideological reasons. I didn't get around to it. But yes, our boy King. I was going to call him. Yes, get it, King.
King Camp.
King Camp. He's the king of camp. Oh, there's so many ways you can go with that. Gillette, it's true. And back to your South America thing. I wonder if it was because they didn't have a factory that made them. They had to import them, perhaps? Or?
Yeah, imported. They were actually the only razors I can find. There were two kinds, and they were both, in my opinion, ludicrously expensive. But back at this time, people needed these razors. There was definitely a market. We also have to consider the role of gas mask, because gas mask would not seal properly if someone had a beard. And so people had to shave if they wanted to survive being gassed.
Yeah, and that comes from a really great BBC article called The Mustache, A Hairy History. Check that one out as well. That's interesting. You know, it wouldn't seal because the little hairs would just poke through there, and then you could get contaminated.
And so now, with this rise and fall, waxing and waning of popularity for the beard, the mustache becomes a statement of maturity and masculinity, according to Christopher Oldstone Moore, who wrote of Beards and Men, the Revealing History of Facial Hair. Men who stuck with mustaches at this time were either older men sticking to the older standard, you know, kind of this military look, or they were strong-willed individualists who didn't need or care to follow the new rules of cooperative manliness. So there you have it, folks. The mustache becomes a statement. That's our main takeaway here. Now let's fast forward a little bit to the rise of the first modern restaurants in Paris. These started out as establishments for the wealthy, and we're getting some of this from a great article on Atlas Obscura. The restaurants wanted to recreate the feeling of dining in a very nice place, an opulent mansion, a palace, what have you. And this means there was this sort of gestalt experience. It was not just about the food. The waiters, the service staff also had to look like domestic valets. And domestic valets at this time and traditionally were not allowed to wear mustaches as a sign of their rank.
That's right. Much like that British officer's uniform where it was required. And in this article, a historian named Gil Mahaley was quoted as saying that diners were actually able to essentially pay a fee to humiliate these people. In a bizarre institutional kind of way, which seems very cruel.
Yeah, because they were paying for food, sure, but they were also paying for the experience of being the master
bossing someone around. Yeah,
which is why, first off, never say garçon, because
garçon means boy,
right? And that in itself is kind of a reference to this dynamic that was going on, according to Gil Mahaley. This idea of regulating facial hair in France is rooted in colonialist expansion and the Industrial Revolution because people who were less well off had more access to what had once been luxury goods. And when that happened, the elite, the haves of society, had to turn to stuff money couldn't buy for a new way of communicating their status.
Gil Mahaley, by the way, is—I don't think we're pronouncing that quite correctly because he is French, but he is, among other things, an editor at Caussure magazine in French, a French publication, and has written very extensively on the role of masculinity in French culture.
Mm-hmm. And that's why he comes into the picture with this facial hair ban. So now the elites want to communicate their status through their right or their privilege of possessing facial hair. And according to Gil, it was intensely humiliating for people in France to return from a war and then be told that they have to shave their mustache just to get a job. He says that to be denied the mustache was to be demeaned, infantilized, emasculated, even depatriated in front of their families, neighbors, and friends.
Man, that is assigning a lot of meaning to the stash.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you see where we're going with this. Yeah, it really felt as though you were being stripped of your freedom, your liberté. Did I say that right, Casey? Liberté?
La liberté.
Liberté. Yeah. Casey on the case.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was a an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer-founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
And this all leads us to the great French mustache strike of 1907. Casey, here's this ad. We're just going to read this ad to you, okay? And this ties in all that stuff we were talking about at the beginning. Hotel keepers refuse to yield, bitterly opposed to plan for arbitration with striking Paris waiters. Big American tips blamed. Bill before parliament to make it impossible for employers to bar employees' mustaches.
Right. And that's the thing. Americans actually were a big part, if indirectly, for this strike. You can't really understate how important the culture of American tipping is in this whole thing. We talked about it at the top of the show. I was blissfully unaware, as I have not traveled outside of the United States in a hot minute, that you don't tip. In Europe. Is it Europe in as a whole or is it just France?
I think it varies a little bit country to country.
Got it.
Yeah. But in general, the idea of tipping 20% is an American concept.
And I don't care for it particularly. I get how the system works, but I'm like, just charge me what the food is worth. Just charge. Like, I love it when the tip is built into the check. And I don't have to think about it because it creates all of this like one-upsmanship, right?
You know, the thing about a meal for me is I think a good meal should end with maybe coffee or a dessert, not having to do math.
Yeah, exactly. But so, you know, the French not into this concept either.
Sure.
And when American tourists would come, it raised the specter of tipping in a culture that hadn't really had to contend with it. Because there was some tipping already in French culture at this time, which was in the early 1900s. But it was nominal at best. I think the kind of influx of American tourism really raised the bar on tipping because Americans were more used to tipping.
Right. And as we see this increase in the average tip for the average Parisian restaurant employee, we see that the owners of cafes and restaurants are also clocking that rise in income, and they start levying charges on their staff to get, you know, their cut of the pie. So the waiters go on strike at these high-end restaurants, and they demand better pay, more time off, and they say, hey, let us grow our mustaches out. Let us have the facial hair we want. At the time, this the mustache had been almost ubiquitous amongst male French residents for decades. And priests, domestic servers, and waiters were often not allowed to have it. They said it was forced shaving. They felt sentenced to forced shaving. And according to one estimate, when they did finally strike, they cost the city roughly 25,000 francs a day in revenue.
I just wanted to jump in here real quick. The word, the French word for tipping is pourboire, mm-hmm. which roughly means like for drinking. It's like drinking money. So you can kind of see just implied in the word itself that they're not necessarily talking about somebody's livelihood. It's just like mm-hmm. a little bonus to kind of, you know, reward really good service, but it's not going to like pay your bills.
Oh, drinking money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not like drinking money.
No, no, no. Okay. It's just like, you know, beer money.
Got it. Yeah. Got it.
Casey on the case.
Always. Da-da.
So according to one contemporaneous newspaper, there's a line here that I thought you would enjoy. Women are quite determined to starve with their children rather than see the whiskers of their husbands still fall under the razor. So the families were supporting the guys striking, and they were like, no, you're not a man. And like, you know what? You know what, Francis? The man I married, he had a mustache.
Sure did. But, you know, it wasn't all support for the striking waiters. I mean, there were some folks that were like, what are you guys doing? Like, you know, this is, that's how it always is with strikes. I mean, not always, but like, there's going to be folks that like just look at it as like being greedy or trying to, you know, get more money, or if there's no real hardship involved. Like, you know, one thing when like coal miners are living in horrific conditions and striking for better pay, better working conditions. But this is, you know, I could see how there could be some detractors for this.
Sure. And there's also sort of a know your place, lowly peasant kind
right.
of vibe.
That's true. That's true. And am I on the wrong side of history here, Ben?
No. Okay. I mean, it's strange because the people who stayed were considered, like, not everybody quit, obviously. And some people jumped in to fill the new positions that had opened up. But the people who stayed were considered kind of traitors, scabs.
And ah, yes.
Strikers were like, come on, man, what's going on? Don't you also want to be a man and grow your mustache? There's a weird LA Times report from April 20th of 1907 that includes some of my favorite innocent bystanders. So the authorities are trying to clear out these strikers, right? And they expel every clean-shaven man, including, apparently, a dozen innocent Americans who had just arrived in town, knew nothing about the strike, and were astonished by how hostile the police were.
Were they given a walloping?
Yeah, well, they were forcefully pushed out of town, mm-hmm. yeah.
Literally, ran out of town on a rail. How do you like that?
So what do we know about the details of this strike? A lot of our information does come from Gil Mihaly, but some of the details are still unclear, right?
What was the Dreyfus Affair?
Dreyfus Affair, that's tricky territory to get into, but basically it's where this guy was falsely accused of, I don't even remember what, but there was a lot. It was like a proxy for anti-Semitism, basically. Mm-hmm. It's still referred to today in kind of contemporary French culture, the Dreyfus Affair. And Roman Polanski, his new film is called J'accuse, and it is also about the Dreyfus Affair and him kind of comparing himself to Dreyfus.
Really?
Yep.
Really?
A little bit gross.
Because the Dreyfus Affair, the guy was falsely accused.
That is true.
Polanski's
on the record. I mean, there's no question that it happened. So,
Polanski knows what he did.
Yeah.
Society knows what he did.
And there's also some new charges for Polanski that have come out just within the last month or so.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What are those? More?
Just more allegations of him doing, you know, terrible stuff.
What happened to good old-fashioned, like, dirtbag crimes? Why aren't people, like, bouncing checks and doing small-time cons for wristwatches?
It's a good question, Ben. It was simpler. It was a simpler time. But the reason I bring up the Dreyfus affair is because that, I know it's complex, Casey, and I appreciate you shedding some light on it for us, but it was another one of these kind of high watermark moments of like what is French identity, kind of, you know? And this is obviously a little more of a frivolous example, but this mustache strike was as well.
Yeah, yeah. We don't know exactly how many people went on strike or exactly when they started striking. The numbers that we've been able to gather have a pretty wide range. Some say hundreds were striking, others say thousands, and others say that it came and went in waves. People argued different facts, you know, and some people were against the strike just for scientific reasons, for hygienic concerns. They said, look, if people wear mustaches, are they going to clean them? Is this detritus and scruff from their mustache going to go into the food we eat? Someone else pointed out in Le Journal on April 22nd, they said, watching a mustache man eat, certainly a common sight in the day's restaurants, regardless of the appearance of the waitstaff, is repugnant to the viewer.
That wounds me to the quick, Ben. But I will say that even today, like, I mean, you're not allowed to. A lot of police people that work in kitchens and stuff, they have to wear like beard nets.
Yeah.
Which is the most humiliating thing in the whole world.
I don't know. I always thought it was a hygienic thing. Right?
It is a hygienic thing, but it looks ridiculous.
Mm. And I always wonder whether they actually work. You know what I mean?
It just seems like a lot of humiliation for not much payoff. But I don't know. I get it. I've seen my beard hairs make their way into the food that I'm eating occasionally. I would be grossed out if I saw an unrecognized hair. I'm used to my own beard hairs, but others, no thank you.
Right. So this cause catches fire for its the people opposed to it, the people supporting the strikers. It eventually reaches Parliament, where a guy named Antide Boyer, the socialist deputy from Marseille, makes a bill. He proposes a bill in Parliament that says, let's make it illegal to ban mustaches. And let's say that if we catch you banning mustaches in your restaurant or place of business, you could be imprisoned for up to 3 months. And weirdly enough, he introduced this bill before the 1907 strike began. We have a pretty good quote from him in the New York Times.
That's right. Boyer in the New York Times described the bill as the product of some misguided nobleman and presumptuous middle-class folk cling to the belief that they are honoring themselves by forbidding their servants, whom they treat as slaves, to wear mustaches. Such a practice under a democratic republic is grotesque and humiliating. He went on to say that a resurrection of bygone tyranny, contrary to the principles contained in the Declaration of the Rights of Man, was another way of looking at this affront.
So he's saying, hypocrites, hypocrites all. This bill fails, but luckily it turned out not to be necessary because by May, waiters across the city of Paris had won back the right to wear mustaches. Oddly enough, in negotiations, some waiters chose to take the right to wear a mustache in exchange for some of their other demands. So they made concessions on things like pay or days off.
Really?
To keep their mustaches.
Garnish my wages. Just don't take away my mustache.
Mm-hmm.
That's very intense. They really felt strongly about these mustaches.
So this kind of became a symbolic victory for some. And in material terms, they weren't winning that much. So according to the historians, maybe the waiters got hoodwinked, or maybe the strike was only kind of about labor and workers' rights. Maybe it was more about the ability to define oneself and the concept of belonging as an equal in society.
So the bill didn't pass, but a lot of folks were able to get their rights to mustaches back. And there was actually another slightly less spectacular mustache strike in 1908, thereabouts. That kind of ended without much fuss. Because at the end of the day, you know, if your employer requires you to dress a certain way or wear a certain thing. You can choose to work there or choose not to work there, right?
It's tough. It depends on the market. What if there's only one kind of job you can get?
That's a good point, Ben.
So this concludes our episode, but not our show. We haven't even trimmed the edges of the complex role mustaches play in various societies, facial hair in general.
I like what you did there, though.
Thank you, man.
That was good.
I hid it in my stash of terrible jokes.
Oh, my God, man. You're on fire.
No, this is terrible.
You should be set on fire, is what I meant.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%.
Got it. But thankfully, we work in podcasting, where we can wear our facial hair however we damn well please.
Yeah, look, we are garbage fires sometimes in the studio. And we try to sound like we are better dressed than we are.
Just roll in here with tattered sweatpants.
Yeah. I'm in my baby Yoda onesie, you know?
You are right now.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
I'm rocking this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm wearing a Panda Bear Kigurumi.
And it looks wonderful on you.
It really does. I strike a dashing figure in a fluffy animal costume.
So let us know your favorite facial hair stories. Also, mustaches. Are you for them or against them and why? You can let us know on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, where we are Ridiculous History, Ridiculous History Show, or some variation thereof. You can also find us as individual people and see our various facial hairs on our own stuff. I am Instagram at Ben Bolin and Twitter at Ben Bolin HSW.
You can find me exclusively on Instagram at How Now Noel Brown. Big thanks to super producer Casey Pegram. As always, Alex Williams, who composed our delightful theme that you're hearing this very moment. Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit.
Eve's Jeffcoat, as always. And, of course, Gabe Lousier. And where would we be without the Quizzelator, the Quizterino, a.k.a. Young Quizzles, a.k.a. Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. the Quizter.
A.k.a. the Quizzler makes mouths happy. Thanks to you, Ben.
Hey, likewise, Noel. And thanks... you know what? While we're thanking everybody, thanks to all the people who haven't been jerks to folks about how they want to dress or look.
Agreed. See you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills, into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.